That, for the most part, proved true. Code enforcement. To enforce the regulations, the NIRA employed its own police force. In the Garment District of New York, the code enforcers roamed through the area like stormtroopers. They entered factories, lined up workers, and subjected them to interrogation. They expelled the factory owners from their own establishments to examine their books and records. Since night work was forbidden, the code enforcers battered down the doors of several factories with axes, looking for workers who were committing the crime of sewing a pair of pants after the mandated closing hour. The fascistic policy of the NIRA was crystallized in the case of Jack Magid, a New Jersey tailor. Magid pressed a suit for 35 cents, 5 cents less than the tailor code rate. For this offense, the tailor was arrested, convicted, fined $500, and sent to prison. The case created a public uproar. A judge hastily summoned Magid from his jail cell, remitted his sentence and fine, and offered to give the offender his own pants to press. Roosevelt's Revenge. On May 27, 1935, the Supreme Court ruled that the NIRA violated the borders of the U.S. Constitution. Extraordinary conditions may call for extraordinary remedies, the court decreed, but the argument necessarily stops short of an attempt to justify action which lies outside the sphere of constitutional authority. Extraordinary conditions do not create or enlarge constitutional power. The ruling may have stayed the transformation of America into a fascist state, but it failed to prevent Roosevelt and his Wall Street backers from creating an occult economy. Roosevelt retaliated by sending a bill to Congress that would enable him to appoint as many as 6 additional Supreme Court justices. But eventually this assault on the checks and balances of power proved to be too much for the president's friends on Capitol Hill to swallow, and the court-packing plan met with rejection. Former Chief Justice William Rehnquist later observed, "President Roosevelt lost the court-packing battle, but he won the war for control of the Supreme Court, not by any novel legislation, but by serving in office for more than 12 years and appointing 8 of the 9 justices of the court." Changing times. The New Deal represented more than an attempt to impose a fascist system of government upon the American people. It also constituted a concerted attempt by the House of Rockefeller to gain control of the Federal Reserve and the financial domination of the United States. The success of this coup, which toppled the House of Morgan, was due to an alliance which the Rockefeller family formed with such burgeoning American financial establishments as Harriman Brown & Company, which included George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush as partners, Lehman Brothers and Goldman Sachs, which had managed to push Kuhn, Loeb & Company into the background. The harbinger of this revolution was the Rockefellers' successful takeover of Morgan's flagship commercial bank, Chase National Bank of New York. After the 1929 crash, Winthrop W. Aldrich, son of Senator Nelson Aldrich and brother-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., engineered a merger of his Rockefeller-controlled Equitable Trust Company into Chase Bank. From that point on, Aldrich engaged in a titanic struggle with Chase. By 1932, managing to oust Morgan's Chase CEO Albert Wigan from office and to take his place as the head of the gigantic financial firm. Thanks to this ouster, Chase has remained the financial headquarters of the House of Rockefeller. Part 5. The Occult Economy. No free man shall ever be debarred the use of arms. Thomas Jefferson.
The New World Order cannot happen without U.S. participation, as we are the most significant single component. Yes, there will be a New World Order, and it will force the United States to change its perceptions.
Henry Kissinger, World Affairs Council Press Conference, Regent Beverly Wilshire Hotel, April 19, 1994. to compel a man to subsidize with his taxes the propagation of ideas which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. Thomas Jefferson. 18. Confiscated gold. All persons are hereby required to deliver on or before May 1, 1933, to a Federal Reserve Bank, or a branch or agency thereof, or to any member bank of the Federal Reserve System, all gold coin, gold bullion, and gold certificates, now owned by them, or coming into their ownership, on or before April 28, 1933. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Executive Order, 6102. For centuries, the banking system was based on a gold standard, and the price of gold was established by law. In the United States, this price, prior to the arrival of FDR in the White House, was fixed at $20.07 per ounce. This set price served not only to prevent inflation and deflation, but also to establish the limits of the money supply, since honest paper currency could not be issued without adequate principal, that is, gold. Gold represented real wealth that could protect any country from financial collapse. For this reason, the gold reserves of the United States were stored under armed guard in a vault 86 feet beneath the first floor of the New York Federal Reserve Bank on Nassau Street. By 1927, the vault, which was half the size of a football field, contained 10% of all the gold reserves in the world. In 1933, when Roosevelt became president, the United States had the largest gold reserves of any nation in the world. On March 8, 1933, a few days after taking the oath of office, he announced to the American public that the gold standard was safe. 3 days later, however, he issued an executive order forbidding gold payments by banks. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau, Jr., the son of a CFR founding member, said that the measure was aimed at those who hoarded quantities of gold and thereby hindered the government's plans for a restoration of public confidence. The gold ban. The order backfired. Thousands of Americans, fearful that their paper money was becoming worthless, withdrew their savings from banks to purchase gold from foreign and domestic markets. On April 5, 1933, Roosevelt responded to the mounting banking crisis by ordering all American citizens to surrender their gold to the government. No one in America was now allowed to own more than $100 in gold coins. Roosevelt assured the country, "The order is limited to the period of the emergency." But the ban of owning gold remained on the books until 1974. 9 months later, Executive Order 6102 became law. The Gold Reserve Act of 1934. The gold began to pour into the coffers of the Federal Reserve Bank in Washington, D.C. Guards armed with machine guns oversaw the transportation of gold bullion and coins from national and state banks throughout the country.
"I am keeping my finger on the gold," Roosevelt announced to the press, and he did.
The gold that was confiscated and locked within the vaults of the Fed was never returned to the American people. Citizens become criminals. The federal mandate implied that government was the rightful owner of all the gold in the nation, and that no American had a right to possess the precious metal. Roosevelt branded all those who did not turn over their gold as hoarders.
He defined hoarding as the withdrawal and withholding of gold coin, gold bullion, or gold certificates from the recognized and customary channels of trade.
Citizens had accepted a paper currency based on the government's pledge to redeem it in gold at $20.07 per ounce. Then, when Roosevelt decided to default on that pledge, he also felt obliged to turn all citizens holding gold into criminals. Scores of Americans were now rounded up, fined, and sent to the slammer for having a fistful of gold dollars. Foreigners also had gold confiscated and were forced to accept paper money as payment. The Übersee Finanzkorporation, a Swiss banking company, had $1.25 million in gold coins for business use, which it entrusted to an American firm for safekeeping. In 1934, the Übersee Finanz officials were shocked to find that their gold was confiscated by the U.S. government. They made appeals, but the appeals were denied. The officials were told that they were only entitled to paper money, but not their gold coins. The Swiss company would have lost 40% of their gold's value if they tried to buy the same amount of gold with the paper money they received in exchange for their confiscated coins. Roosevelt stated that the ban on private ownership of the precious metal was the first step also to that complete control of all monetary gold in the United States, which was essential in order to give the government that element of freedom of action which was necessary as the very basis of its monetary goal and objective. The Fed now began to churn out cash at an unprecedented level. The dollar lost 93% of its purchasing power, while the value of an ounce of gold rose to $35. A congressman's outcry. In 1933, Representative Lewis T. McFadden of Pennsylvania took to the floor of Congress to denounce FDR's action as follows. Roosevelt seized the gold value of $40 billion or more of bank deposits in the United States banks. Those deposits were deposits of gold values. By his action, he has rendered them payable to the depositors in paper only, if payable at all, and the paper money he proposes to pay out to bank depositors and to the people generally in lieu of their hard-earned gold values in itself, and being based on nothing into which the people can convert it, the said paper money is of negligible value altogether. The people of the U.S. are now using unredeemable paper slips for money. The Treasury cannot redeem that paper in gold or silver. The gold and silver of the Treasury has unlawfully been given to the corrupt and dishonest Fed. And the administration has since had the effrontery to raid the country for more gold for the private interests by telling our patriotic citizens that their gold is needed to protect the currency. It is not being used to protect the currency. It is being used to protect the corrupt and dishonest Fed. The directors of these institutions have committed criminal offense against the United States government, including the offense of making false entries on their books and the still more serious offense of unlawfully abstracting funds from the United States Treasury. Roosevelt's gold raid is intended to help them out of the pit they dug for themselves when they gambled away the wealth and savings of the American people. In the wake of making these remarks, McFadden experienced two attempts on his life. The first came in the form of two gunmen who fired at the congressman after he alighted from a cab in front of a leading hotel in the nation's capital. The shots missed him. The second occurred when McFadden ingested food that had been poisoned at a Washington political gathering. His life was saved by a physician friend who procured a stomach pump and administered emergency treatment. The rescue, however, failed to save the country from its inevitable fate. In 1936, McFadden was voted out of office. A presidential puppet. After confiscating the gold from American citizens and purchasing it from foreign sources, the Roosevelt administration appeared to set the price of the precious metal at random. Every morning at 9 o'clock, Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, Jesse Jones, the head of the Financial Reconstruction Corporation, and George Warren, the country's leading economic advisor, would meet with FDR over his breakfast of soft-boiled eggs to determine the gold price for that day. They began at $31.36 an ounce. The next morning, this rate was hiked to $31.54, then $31.76, and $31.82. It seemed as though they were acting at random. The morning exercise only served to push the price a little higher than the day before. On November 3, 1933, Roosevelt suggested that the cost of an ounce of gold should be raised 21 cents. When the others asked why, the president explained that it was a lucky number, 3 times 7. But the pricing was neither arbitrary nor capricious. Roosevelt, throughout his years in the Oval Office, remained manipulated by the money trust. In FDR, my exploited father-in-law, Curtis Dahl, a syndicate manager for Lehman Brothers who married Anna Eleanor Roosevelt, wrote,
"For a long time, I felt that FDR had developed many thoughts and ideas that were his own to benefit this country, the United States. But he didn't. Most of his thoughts, his political ammunition, as it were carefully manufactured for him in advance by the Council on Foreign Relations, One World Money Group. Brilliantly, with great gusto, like a fine piece of artillery, he exploded that prepared ammunition in the middle of an unsuspecting target, the American people, and thus paid off and returned his internationalist political support."
Roosevelt, as Liaquat Ahmed confirmed in Lords of Finance, did not even pretend to grasp the subtleties of international finance. He received direction, in part, from James Warburg, who served as FDR's chief financial advisor. The son of the founder of the Fed, Warburg Fies, would later tell a U.S. Senate subcommittee, "We shall have a one-world government whether we like it or not. The question is only whether world government will be achieved by consent or conquest." The end of Western civilization. Under the direction of Warburg, Acheson, and other prominent members of the Council on Foreign Relations, Roosevelt secretly removed America from the gold standard. Informed of this decision, Lewis Douglas, the director of the Bureau of the Budget, proclaimed the end of Western civilization. The value of the dollar plummeted, the prices for everyday goods skyrocketed, and unemployed Americans wandered the streets and asked, "Brother, can you spare a dime?" And yet, as the Depression deepened, the Federal Reserve began to purchase the foreign debts of Germany, France, and Great Britain to provide steamer trunks filled with bonds and notes to prop up failing foreign economies, while so much gold continued to pour into the vaults of the Federal Reserve in New York that Roosevelt ordered the creation of Fort Knox, another federal gold depository in Louisville, Kentucky. 19. The Mother Bank.
It must not be felt that these heads of the world's chief central banks were themselves substantive powers in world finance. They were not. Rather, they were the technicians and agents of the dominant investment bankers of their own countries, who had raised them up and were perfectly capable of throwing them down. The substantive financial powers of the world were in the hands of these investment bankers, also called international or merchant bankers, who remained largely behind the scenes in their own unincorporated private banks. These formed a system of international cooperation and national dominance, which was more private, more powerful, and more secret than that of their agents in the central banks. This dominance of investment bankers was based on their control over the flows of credit and investment funds in their own countries and throughout the world. They could dominate the financial and industrial systems of their own countries by their influence over the flow of current funds through bank loans, the discount rate, and the rediscounting of commercial debts. They could dominate governments by their control over current government loans and the play of the international exchanges. Almost all of this power was exercised by the personal influence and prestige of men who had demonstrated their ability in the past to bring off successful financial coup to keep their word, to remain cool in a crisis, and to share their winning opportunities with their associates. In this system, the Rothschilds had been preeminent during much of the 19th century, but at the end of that century, they were being replaced by J.P. Morgan, whose central office was in New York, although it was always operated as if it were in London, where it had indeed originated, as George Peabody and Company in 1838.
Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope. On May 17, 1930, the start of the Great Depression, the Bank of International Settlements, BIS, a private financial institution, opened its headquarters in Basel, Switzerland. The major shareholders were the Bank of England, the Bank of France, the National Bank of Belgium, Reichsbank, the J.P. Morgan Company, the Morgan-owned First National Bank of New York, the Morgan-owned First National Bank of Chicago, and the Bank of Japan, which was controlled by the Iwasaki and Dan families, two of Japan's wealthiest clans. These families, which had formed a partnership with Jack Morgan, owned Mitsubishi and Mitsui, two companies that emerged from the 17th century shogunates. Eventually, the Federal Reserve would purchase shares in the Basel Bank and become the leading player in directing its activities. The original purpose of the BIS was to facilitate the recurring problem of the war reparations that had been imposed upon Germany. Although buoyed through the Roaring Twenties by the Dawes Plan, Germany was faced with a new disaster. When Wall Street crashed in 1929, American investors frantically pulled out of their German investments. Foreign capital was no longer flowing into the Rhineland. The country was, once again, broke and unable to come up with the mandated annual payment of $625 million to France and England. To settle this new crisis, the Young Conference, named in honor of Owen Young, its chairman, was held in Paris in 1929. Young, like Dawes, was closely tied to the houses of Morgan and Rockefeller and served as the president and chairman of the General Electric Company and RCA. A compromise had been reached at the Young Conference. The Germans would pay $500 million a year for the next 36 years to England and France, and $375 million for the next 22 years after that to cover the Allies' debt to the United States. The plan was approved at the first Hague Conference. Control of the German economy was returned to Berlin, and a new bank, the Bank of International Settlements, was established to administer the payments. The BIS would serve to commercialize the payments, that is, to issue bonds against them, and would act as a lender to the Reichsbank, Germany's central bank, if the German currency weakened and the government found itself unable to make payments. Another Morgan monster. Among its founders of BIS were J.P. Jack Morgan, Owen D. Young, Thomas Lamont, Seymour Parker Gilbert, Jackson Reynolds, and Gates W. McGarra. Young had served as chairman of both the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, which was owned by the House of Rockefeller, and General Electric, which was owned by the House of Morgan. Lamont was Morgan's banking partner, an ambassador to the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, and a member of the Jekyll Island Club. Gilbert, another Morgan partner, had served as the Undersecretary of Treasury for the Harding administration. Reynolds was a director of the Federal Reserve of New York and a Morgan economic advisor. McGarra, who became the first president of BIS, was an official at Chase Manhattan, owned by the House of Rockefeller, and the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The Central Banker's Central Bank. Despite the fact that it was established as a result of the Young Conference, the BIS, in its statement of purpose, made no mention of the mandated reparations. It rather maintained that its objective was to promote the cooperation of central banks and to provide additional facilities for international operations and to act as trustees or agents in regard to international financial settlements entrusted to it under agreements with the parties concerned. Throughout its history, the BIS referred to itself not as an institution of settlements, but rather as the central banker's central bank, a place where bankers could meet in secret, away from the prying eyes of the press and the nagging demands of the politicians. The constitution of the BIS was written by Sir Walter Leighton, editor of The Economist. Leighton, in tandem with the Rothschild family, had created a consortium of British businessmen to promote a united Europe. The concept of a central bank had been advanced during the 1920s by British economist John Maynard Keynes, who called for the creation of a supranational bank that would take command of all national economies, set the exchange rate of all currencies, and manage the value of gold according to a standard commodity index. Since the wealth of the world was being confined more and more to 8 banking families, the formation of a bank to rule all banks appeared to be inevitable. In 1925, Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England, sent the following note to Benjamin Strong, governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
"I rather hope that next summer we may be able to inaugurate a private and eclectic central bank's club, small at first, large in the future."
A fortress impregnable. The headquarters of the BIS was a renovated hotel near the Basel Central Railroad Station, where meetings were held under tight security and complete secrecy. No minutes, agenda, or attendance list was published in any form, and the building became inviolate, meaning that the Swiss authorities possessed no authority over its premises. Correspondence to the bank was received by diplomatic couriers. Such measures were necessary to safeguard the true purpose of the bank, which Carol Quigley, one of America's leading economists, described as follows.
"The powers of financial capitalism had a far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert, by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations."
Gaining gold. As soon as it was established, the BIS abandoned its efforts to settle the matter of Germany's delinquent payments for reparations and took up the task of stabilizing the world's economies. To accomplish this task, it was allocated control of the gold reserves that were held by its member banks. Gold now flowed out of Japan, Europe, and the United States into Basel. But the lion's share of the precious metal came from China. During the 1930s, Chiang Kai-shek, chairman of the nationalist government, was facing war on 2 fronts, from Mao Zedong's communist insurgency and Imperial Japan. As his government became increasingly unstable, Chiang began to transfer massive amounts of Chinese gold to the BIS and the Federal Reserve. A story concerning the transfer of 203.43 metric tons to Basel and New York was reported by the New York Times on February 19, 1937. In 1938, Chiang transported an additional 125,000 metric tons of gold for safekeeping. Controlling countries. Thanks to the power of this combined wealth, the BIS could save a country from economic disaster or drive it into a tailspin, and its transnational actions could take place without political or governmental interference. In the first 6 months of 1931, the BIS advanced $10 million to the Bank of Spain to stabilize the peseta, gave a credit of 100 million Austrian shillings to the Bank of Austria when the Credit Anstalt Bank went belly up, and advanced $5 million to the Hungarian National Bank, which was experiencing a revenue shortfall. The activities of the BIS superseded all political, moral, and religious ideologies. The sole concern was the control of capital by the flow of money. Capital represented the resources required to produce goods, coal, oil, iron ore, factories, machine tools, trucks, and roads. Money was the means of purchasing capital. By manipulating the money supply and determining the value of all currencies, the directors of the BIS could hold absolute control over state and society. Personal principles were superfluous. Thus it came to pass that a group of international bankers, including members of the Reichsbank, met each month to manage international economies and to plan a one-world order, while war raged around them. And no one objected when Paul Heckler, a German deputy manager at the BIS, signed his correspondence, Heil Hitler. 20. The Mother Boxes.
If these bonds were indeed forgeries, it implies that the box itself might be fake as well, which raises the question. Why would counterfeiters go through the effort of not only faking $6 trillion in $1 billion bonds, but also go through the effort of creating a fake Treaty of Versailles mother box? When I try to imagine the mindset of a thief, I cannot bring myself to understand why I would counterfeit two things instead of just one, thus doubling my chances of forgeries being detected. Furthermore, why hide the bonds in makeshift compartments within the mother box? It all just makes so little sense, I'm not sure what to think at this point.
Madison Ruppert, End the Lie, 2012. The secret shipments of gold would permit the Federal Reserve and the Bank for International Settlements to create an occult economy. In exchange for the precious metal received for safekeeping, bonds and notes of astronomical value were issued by the Fed and dispatched to the BIS, which deployed them to central and commercial banks throughout the world to bolster flailing economies. The worth of the bonds and notes was based on the value of the gold that had been blacklisted, that is, removed from the market and stored away from circulation and scrutiny in vaults. This undertaking was conducted with utmost secrecy. If the public discovered how much precious metal actually existed in storage, economic shock waves would reverberate throughout the world, and gold would lose much of its value overnight. On the eve of the outbreak of the Sino-Japanese War, wealthy Chinese families, including members of the Dragon Dynasty, delivered their gold reserves to Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of nationalist China, for safekeeping in the Federal Reserve. Regular shipments of gold were loaded on U.S. naval ships and transported to the Federal Reserve. When the war broke out, 7 tankers fully loaded with gold bars purportedly made their way to New York from China. In exchange for these massive deposits, they received guarantees from the Fed in the form of billion-dollar bonds. The Mysterious Mother Boxes. The bonds arrived in sealed bronze and copper containers the size of steamer trunks and became known as mother boxes. With each mother box were 12 8.5 by 11-inch sized baby boxes carved out of a single piece of durable wood. They were 2.5 inches deep, making them big enough to store a ream of paper. The baby boxes were faced and sealed with bronze-colored sheet metal for protection. The gold certificates that they contained were in the amount of $100,000, $1 million, $100 million, and even $1 billion. Since the bonds were sent to Basel, presumably to resolve the issue of war reparations, the Treaty of Versailles was engraved in gold letters on each mother box, along with the insignia of the United States. The face value of every trunk was $3 trillion. The Federal Reserve notes were placed in silver-colored metal containers the size of attaché cases, with a face value of $50 billion. For deposit only. If the gold certificates were cashed, the payout could have crashed the U.S. economy, which had nowhere near enough money to honor them. The plan was to keep the bonds and notes on deposit, along with the gold that was issued against them. Their total value was not derived from a vacuum. It was based on the total amount that had been squirreled away by countries and central banks in the BIS system. This extraordinary deployment of gold certificates from the Federal Reserve served to establish the dollar as the currency for international exchange, and to fortify the United States as the economic bedrock of a world ravaged by war and depression. Careful measures were undertaken to protect the certificates. The bonds, boxes, and chests contained deliberate, glaring errors in spelling and grammar, so that they would be dismissed as fake by almost any public official or banking authority who examined them. Hard evidence. The truth about the boxes began to come out of the shadows at the dawn of the 21st century. In January 2000, Chris Estrella, a Filipino social worker, led a troop of five porters out of a Mindanao jungle with a weather-beaten iron and leather box crammed with $25 billion of U.S. government bearer bonds. The elders of the Umayamnon tribe had informed him that an American plane crashed in a river near their village in the 1930s. The river dried up in the 1990s, and the natives went into the plane and found 12 boxes that contained $300 billion in bonds. Each box was emblazoned with the Great Seal of the United States and the words Federal Reserve Bond. They rested on top of a stack of certificates purporting to have been issued by the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta in 1934 and to be redeemable in gold bullion. The notes bore the signature of then-Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau. The story received coverage from the mainstream press, including Bloomberg News. On June 16, 2009, Mitsuyoshi Watanabe and Akihito Yamaguchi, two Japanese couriers for the Chinese Dragon family, were arrested in Italy with a stack of 1934 U.S. Treasury bearer bonds with a face value of $134 billion. They had recently arrived in Ponte Chiasso, a small town near the Swiss border, from the same area of the Philippines where Chris Estrella had found the iron and leather box. Watanabe and Yamaguchi were about to board a train headed for the Bank of International Settlements in Basel. The bonds were located in the false bottom of one of their suitcases. The Guardia di Finanza, Italy's financial police, called upon Robert Gombar, head of the U.S. Secret Service in Italy, to authenticate the certificates, which bore the signature of Henry Morgenthau, Jr., and a metal plate stating, Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. Gombar deemed them to be fraudulent and said, "There's no such thing as a $500 million treasury bond. It's like counterfeiting a $3 bill, something that doesn't exist." Since the Italian authorities lacked evidence that the couriers were intent on selling the bonds, the case was closed and the suspects were released. But news later surfaced about their employer. The Dragon family had decided to cash in their bonds. A twisted tale. The authorities purportedly refused to release the bonds to the couriers. Instead, they turned them over to Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, who redeemed them for cash. Half of the cash, according to this account, was turned over to the Federal Reserve in New York, and the redeemed bonds were placed in storage in a program operated by the United Nations. At this point, the curious tale becomes even more twisted. Yamaguchi, one of the couriers, now contacted Irish-American businessman Neil Keenan on behalf of the Dragons and commissioned him to liquidate another box of 1934 Federal Reserve bonds with a face value of $124.5 billion for cash. This task purportedly brought Keenan in contact with Daniela Dal Bosco, a Vatican banker, who said that he could provide adequate financial redemption. The deal seemed good to Keenan since Dal Bosco and the Vatican Bank appeared to possess the means to effect a settlement. But after Keenan turned over the securities to Dal Bosco, The Vatican banker engaged in an attempt to sell them in the global marketplace through stealth, conversion, and bribery. At his wit's end, Keenan, on November 23, 2011, filed a lawsuit with the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of New York. The lawsuit targets the Federal Reserve for refusing to honor its financial commitment and names as defendants Daniela Dal Bosco, the Office of International Treasury Control, the United Nations, the Italian Republic, the Guardia di Finanza, Silvio Berlusconi, and the World Economic Forum. More material evidence. At the same time the Japanese couriers were taken into custody, a story crossed the news wires from Barcelona that $1.64 trillion of Federal Reserve notes and bonds, dated 1934, had been seized by Spanish officials. The securities, which were owned by two unidentified businessmen, were lodged within a bronze strongbox which had been engraved with the name of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. They had been shipped to Barcelona from the Philippines. The U.S. gold certificates came in bundles bearing J.P. Morgan Chase metal bands. On February 15, 2012, the Guardia di Finanza collared eight men with ties to organized crime who were involved in an alleged scheme to purchase a large quantity of plutonium from the black market in Nigeria with 1934 U.S. Treasury bearer bonds. While arrests were made in the southern Italian region of Basilicata, the bonds were seized in Zurich. The suspects testified that the bonds, with a face value of $6 trillion, came from Hong Kong and had been issued to Chiang Kai-shek as security for the large shipments of gold he had delivered to the Federal Reserve in New York for safekeeping. In addition to the bonds, which were packed within special metal compartments of a large copper-colored case bearing a plate with the inscription Chicago Federal Reserve System, the Italian police also discovered a copy of the Treaty of Versailles. In an interview with the New York Times, Giovanni Colangelo, the chief prosecutor in the case, said,
"We had heard that they weighed a lot, but frankly, we didn't expect that kind of material."
The gold and 9/11. According to Benjamin Fulford, former Asia-Pacific bureau chief for Forbes magazine, and David Wilcox of the website Divine Cosmos, the Dragon family filed a lawsuit at the International World Court in The Hague in 1998. The trial took place behind closed doors. The decision of the court was ruled in favor of the Dragons, and the Federal Reserve Bank became obligated to return 200,000 tons of gold by September 12, 2001. The day after 9/11. The gold was purportedly stored in the vaults in the basement of the World Trade Center and disappeared after the attack of 9/11. Cantor Fitzgerald Securities, the shipping company in the possession of the insurance and transportation documents, were located in World Trade Center 1. All 600 employees of Cantor Fitzgerald were killed, and all documents vanished with the rubble. The Treasury Police was located in World Trade Center 7. When this building collapsed, their documents were reduced to ashes. The message to the Dragon family was loud and clear. The Fed would neither honor its notes and bonds nor return the gold that had been delivered to it during the Second Sino-Japanese War. Another lawsuit. Another lawsuit involving the 1934 certificates was filed by Joseph Riad on December 22, 2011, in the Eastern District of the U.S. Federal Court in Philadelphia. In the suit, Riad claimed that the Department of Homeland Security had seized 15 $1 billion Federal Reserve bonds from 1934 that he had stashed away in several banks. He said that he had obtained the bonds as collateral for loans he had provided to the South African government. The case merited widespread media attention, since Riad possessed written proof that the bonds were authentic from Kermit Harmon, a security director for the Federal Reserve System. This proof was attached to the lawsuit as an exhibit. Riad produced additional statements of authenticity from A.J. Obara, a bronze metal expert, who verified the date of the boxes in which the bonds were contained. Franklin Nall, a consultant with the Bureau of Public Debt, with an expertise in the history of government-issued high-denomination bonds, and Stuart Eisenstadt, a former deputy security director of the U.S. Treasury Department. Riad said that he met with agents from the Department of Homeland Security who claimed to possess the authority to redeem the 15 bonds. The plaintiff, believing he had struck pay dirt, gave them the bonds and sat back thinking that the check would be in the mail. A week later, he was contacted by the officials who said that the bonds were fake and that they were duty-bound to destroy them. After making several attempts to secure the return of the securities, Riad filed the suit, demanding payment of $15 billion. The case was dismissed with prejudice by U.S. District Judge Mary A. McLaughlin, not on its merits, but rather because it was time-barred under the Federal Tort Claims Act. Riad hadn't filed the suit within 6 months of the date he had received notice that the bonds were being destroyed. With the creation of an occult economy, a cabal of international bankers and businessmen gained control of the world's wealth, not in the form of paper, but of gold, vast gold reserves almost beyond imagination. With such wealth, they could cause vast armies to form, governments to topple, and economies to crash. They could control elections, manipulate the media, and manufacture the news. They could form public opinion, create consensus, and reshape beliefs. In 1938, as the world stood on the brink of war, few Americans had heard of a new world order, and fewer still had realized that it already had come into existence. Part 6. The Breaking of Nations.
I believe that if the people of this nation fully understood what Congress has done to them over the last 49 years, they would move on Washington, and they would not wait for an election. It adds up to a preconceived plan to destroy the economic and social independence of the United States.
George W. Malone, U.S. Senator, Nevada, speaking before Congress in 1957.
The strongest reason for the people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is, as a last resort, to protect themselves against tyranny in government.
Thomas Jefferson.
Winston Churchill said this back in 1920.
From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx, to those of Trotsky, Bella Kuhn, Rosa Luxemburg, and Emma Goldman, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence and impossible equality, has been steadily growing. It played a definitely recognizable role in the tragedy of the French Revolution. It has been the mainspring of every subversive movement during the 19th century, and now at last this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire.
21. The Problem with Hitler.
Break down the thraldom of interest is our war cry. What do we mean by the thraldom of interest? The landowner is under this thraldom, who has to raise loans to finance his farming operations, loans at such a high rate as almost to eat up the results of his labor, or who is forced to make debts and to drag the mortgages after him like so much lead. So is the worker, producing in shops and factories for a pittance, whilst the shareholder draws dividends and bonuses that he has not worked for. So is the earning middle class, whose work goes almost entirely to pay the interest on bank overdrafts. Thraldom of interest is the real expression for the antagonisms, capital versus labor, blood versus money,
creative work versus exploitation. The necessity of breaking this thraldom is of such vast importance that on it depends the hope of recovering happiness, prosperity, and civilization throughout the world.
Gottfried Feder, Adolf Hitler's mentor, the program of the Socialist German Workers' Party. On September 1, 1939, Hitler invaded Poland and initiated World War II. This act of alleged unprovoked aggression violated a war guarantee that British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain had given to a junta of Polish colonels. The guarantee, which was issued several months before the invasion, proclaimed that Britain would deploy all of its military power to protect Polish independence. Why Chamberlain offered such a guarantee remains quizzical. Britain possessed no vital interest in Poland or Eastern Europe, and had drafted no plan to ward off the Wehrmacht, the unified armed forces of Nazi Germany. 6 months after Warsaw received its guarantee, not one British bomb or bullet had been delivered to Poland. No financial credit had been extended to Warsaw by the Bank of England, and no effort was made to dispatch a British military unit to Eastern Europe. What's more, Poland was far from a freedom-loving democracy that merited Britain's protection. Its ruling junta already had crawled into bed with Hitler by collaborating in the carving up of Czechoslovakia and annexing, with the Führer's consent, the territory of Teschen, where thousands of Poles lived. And verification that the guarantee did not stem from any altruistic concern came on September 17th, when Britain neglected to declare war on Stalin for invading and occupying eastern Poland. Polish provocation. The Nazi invasion had not been unprovoked. It had been caused by the Treaty of Versailles, which stripped Germany of its territorial holdings, including the port city of Danzig, which was handed over to Poland. The population of Danzig at the time of the invasion was 97% German. They turned in desperation to the Führer for reunion with their countrymen. They had been subjected to ongoing attacks of wanton savagery in which 58,000 ethnic Germans were murdered by the ruling Polish junta. Hitler reached out to Warsaw with the Marienwerder proposals, which offered these terms. 1. Retention of the existing 1919 borders between Poland and Germany, as determined by the Treaty of Versailles. 2. The return of Danzig to Germany. 3. Construction by the Third Reich of a 60-mile autobahn and railway that would link West and East Prussia from Schönlanke to Marienwerder. 4. An exchange of German and Polish populations. Regarding the proposals, Neville Henderson, the British ambassador to Berlin, wrote,
"I must admit that I regard Hitler's proposals as a fair basis of negotiation, and in my innermost heart I regard the Poles as extremely unwise to make enemies of Germany and as dangerous allies for us. I may be wrong, but I am personally convinced that there can be no permanent peace in Europe until Danzig has reverted to Germany. The Poles cannot be masters of 400,000 Germans in Danzig. Ergo, Germany must be."
The Poles, however, turned down every effort from Hitler to negotiate a settlement. Churchill's war cry. But British officials insisted that the guarantee be honored, even though, as Winston Churchill pointed out, "It must surely lead to the slaughter of tens of millions of people." Despite the fact that the people of Danzig had cried out for deliverance, Churchill insisted that the war must be waged. He wrote,
"If you will not fight for the right when you can easily win without bloodshed, if you will not fight when your victory will be sure and not too costly, you may come to the moment when you have to fight with all the odds against you, and only a precarious chance of survival. There may even be a worse case. You may have to fight when there is no hope of victory, because it is better to perish
than to live as slaves.
Churchill's words remain problematic. Hitler had issued no threats against England, and the British people were not faced with Nazi enslavement. And his statement, as stirring as it may be, neglected to explain why it suddenly had become Britain's duty to fight and die for Poland. Precious British blood. What's more, it remains highly doubtful that Hitler wanted to wage war with Britain. The day before he ordered his stormtroopers to invade the Polish corridor, he issued this directive.
The responsibility for the opening of hostilities in the West should rest unequivocally with England and France. The German land frontier in the West is not to be crossed at any point without my express consent. The same applies to warlike actions at sea, or any which may be interpreted as such. Defensive measures on the part of the Air Force should at first be exclusively confined to the warding off of enemy air attacks on the frontier of the Reich.
German historian Andreas Hillgruber writes,
"The European war that came on September 3rd was as incomprehensible as it was contrary to his, Hitler's, aims."
Proof of Hitler's desire not to create an irreparable breach between England and Germany came when he gave a stop order to his armored units that were closing in on the British forces stranded on the beach of Dunkirk.
"The blood of every single Englishman is too valuable to be shed," he told his friend Frau Gerhardine Troost. "Our two people belong together, racially and traditionally. This is and always has been my aim, even if our generals can't grasp it."
Throughout the war, Hitler made at least 28 attempts to establish unconditional peace with Britain. They were all refused. Hitler's Russian obsession. Nor was Hitler intent upon world conquest. His dreams of conquest remained fixed, not on the West, but the East, and most particularly Russia. In Mein Kampf, published in 1926, Hitler wrote,
"We, National Socialists, consciously draw a line beneath the foreign policy tendency of the pre-war period. We take up where we broke off 600 years ago. We stop the endless German movement to the south and west of Europe and turn our gaze on the land in the east. At long last, we break off the colonial and commercial policy of the pre-war period and shift to the soil policy of the future. If we speak of soil in Europe today, we can primarily have in mind only Russia and her vassal border states."
Hitler's overriding aim was the conquest of Soviet Russia, since he viewed Jews and Bolsheviks as one and the same enemy. Hillgruber writes,
"The conquest of European Russia was for Hitler inextricably linked with the extermination of the Basili, the Jews. In his conception, they had gained dominance over Russia with the Bolshevik Revolution. Russia thereby became the center from which a global danger radiated, particularly threatening to the Aryan race and its Germanic core."
Hitler was a maniacal despot who sent millions of innocent civilians to death camps. Within his death camps, the Führer of the Third Reich stands accused of exterminating over 6 million Jews, gypsies, and people with physical disabilities. But these crimes came to light when Nazi Germany was reduced to rubble, and were not the reason why the Allied nations opted to go to war against him. The reason for war. Through the haze of history, one can discern that a key reason for the outbreak of World War II was financial. On January 7, 1939, Hjalmar Schacht, the president of the Reichsbank, Germany's central bank, which remained bound to the House of Rothschild and the money cartel, refused to provide a loan of 3 billion Reichsmarks to the German government unless Hitler complied with the following demands. 1. The Reich must spend only the amount covered by taxes. 2. Full financial control of the government must be placed with the Ministry of Finance, which was headed by Schacht. 3. Price and wage control must be set in place. The use of money and investment markets must remain at the sole discretion of the Reichsbank. Schacht concluded his memo, which contained his list of demands, with this statement. We shall be happy to do our best to collaborate with all future goals, but for now, the time has come to call a halt. By making these demands, Schacht sought to collapse the German economy, which had